This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, hello there, everyone, and thank you, Parker. I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. Part of what I do here is to collect great stories, which I liken to gold nuggets from my guests. And although I've had today's guest on previously, I wanted to bring him back for two reasons. First, our initial interview ran about an hour long, but I had to take it down to about half that for the purposes of radio. Well, when I did that, I accidentally deleted the entire second half hour with Bob, and he's just now hearing about this for the first time.
Yes, I am.
I was embarrassed. It was early in my program, and it was audio only. So with all that said, I'm happy to report that we get to bring Bob back in for another chat, this time on video. Ladies and gentlemen, Chicago blues harmonicist, owner of the Rhythm Room in Phoenix, Arizona, and longtime host of the Sunday evening program, Those Lowdown Blues, heard live each Sunday in Phoenix on KJZZ, my good friend Bob Corator, or as I affectionately refer to him, Uncle Bob. Come on in and welcome back to Time Signatures. How you doing?
Thank you. You know, it's funny because we have a fundraiser and you so kindly donated to the station. And they go, oh, well, we have your uncle from your nephew from Michigan. I go, nephew from, and I go, oh yeah, okay. I realized it was you. It's pretty funny. So okay,
yes sir,
gotta be careful because people will take that literally. But if you want to be my if you want to be my nephew, you can be my nephew, but I don't think we're that much different in our ages. So that's true. I'm probably much older than you. So
I'll be 61 in April. So you're not that much older.
I'm almost a decade older. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
there you go.
Anyway,
glad to have you, man. Speaking of KJZZ, you recently celebrated a huge milestone with that radio station and your program, Those Lowdown Blues, didn't you?
42 years. So it's not really like a milestone year. 45 will be there if 40 was a milestone year, but 42 is pretty good, you know? So
yeah,
I'm having a good time. We know that there's a joy to being a presenter. It's a powerful thing when you get to present music and stories and information that you personally enjoy and want to share. So it's a cool job. So
well, Bob, how did that program initially come to be? And has it always been 5 hours?
Well, the way I first became aware of the station was when Louisiana Red was staying with me in Phoenix in 1982.
Okay.
He was invited to the station to do an interview and a live on the air performance. And so Red's like, Bobby, will you come and join me for this? I go, of course. So we went over there and I got to check out the station and I really enjoyed it. That was, you know, probably part one. The next part was that there's a wonderful music historian who's like the king of all things Phoenix history. His name is Johnny D or John Dixon. So Johnny invited me on his radio show and I got to spend about an hour and a half on his radio show and play some of the great blues that I loved from my collection. Now,
wow.
I used to do this when I was living in Chicago. I'd have friends come over, and I'd be the king of the turntable, and I'd turn people on to all these cool songs from my collection. And so I always had that kind of spark in me to do that. And so in Johnny D's show, I got to expand that a little bit and do it to a radio audience. Well, that also got me thinking that I would really like to maybe do my own radio show. It was after Louisiana Red left, because he left at the end of 82. And I started the radio show at the beginning of 84.
Okay.
But I contacted the station and offered to do it as a volunteer, which I did for the first year. It was a 1 hour Sunday morning show, and it got apparently a great listenership, because at the end of that year, they said, well, we want to put you on Sunday nights and expand it to a 5 hour show.
Wow.
And so I've been doing that ever since. And it's been pretty crazy. Actually, I think, to be perfectly honest, I think there was another blues program for 1 hour. So I think I was 4 hours. And then when that ended, I just absorbed the extra hour. So it's been 5 hours for as long as I can really remember. So
how cool.
Yeah, it's great. You know, a station that will allow you to be on the air that long, there's something to be said for KJZZ.
Yes.
So they've made a commitment to me. I have a commitment back to them.
Well, I've noticed that there's a lot of NPR stations that do have free range broadcast opportunities. And because I've heard a lot of different blues programs out there on other NPR stations, but how does it feel to you knowing that you've been doing this for more than four decades? This is really cool.
It's just part of what I do. You know, I mean, I have a fairly busy life. I run a nightclub, I'm doing gigs, I'm touring, I'm producing records.
Right.
But Sunday nights are set aside, and Sundays during the day to pull from my collection and plan my radio show, but it's set aside to be with the music that I love. And so I'm really lucky, because I don't have anybody breathing down my neck. I play pretty much a vintage show. It's all the old school stuff.
Yes,
and most of what I play is from the 50s and 60s. And that's really where my interest lies. I go back into the pre-war stuff. I do play some contemporary releases if they're in the old school style. But sure. How often do people get to have that kind of freedom on the air? And I have 5 hours of that every week. And I just flourish in that. So I love to come up with different themes. I love to play all sorts of stuff. I always bring way more music than I can ever fit into just the mere 5 hours. So it's, you know, it's really like counting to infinity to think that you can actually cover all the things you want to cover in a radio show. And so maybe in another 42 years, I'll have achieved that.
I don't know if you could play everything you own in another 42 years. You've sent me photos of your collection, and I think you said that wasn't all of it. If you had to estimate your vinyl and your CD collection, where do you think you're at? Any kind of a number?
Yeah, I'm at about four walls worth.
Four walls?
Floor to ceiling, yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, and I have to tell you, I've seen one photo of like a wall and a half, I think, is what you sent me when you teased me with it.
Yeah.
But clearly you have a listening base for this program, or it wouldn't be here for all these years. So it really does speak to the quality of what you do with these lowdown blues, yeah?
Well, it's actually those lowdown blues, but I guess in our case, it would be these lowdown blues. So, but yeah, you know, it's, I don't know. I try and put out a great show every week, you know. It's a live show, so inevitably I make one or two blunders and hate myself for it, but you know, I have to forgive myself because I'm only human. If I pre-record the show because I'm on tour or something like that, then those are a more perfect show. So that happens sometimes. But you know, if you're in live radio, and sometimes I sneak out of there with 5 hours of no mistakes, I'm like, yes, great. But you know, the humanity of it is, you know, you're dealing with all these 2.5 minute songs. There's going to be some sort of a little mistake that I make. It's usually not a big one, and I've grown to live with my human deficiencies. But overall, you know, I think I put on a pretty tight show. But you and the listeners have to be the judge of that. I can't really say. But I cover the waterfront. I cover, you know, vintage Chicago blues. I cover R&B, early rock and roll. I cover black gospel music and just things that are I think, really important to understand the big full picture of the blues, because, you know, blues is not its own little thing. It was a part of Black popular music, and it really needs to be looked at that way. So there's ballads, yeah. There's sophisticated doo-wop blues. There's all sorts of things that are different. There's down-home country blues from Mississippi, from Texas, from, you know, from the Southeast, all over. So, you know, you just get what you get. And it's fun to kind of like put things in different categories that people can listen to and understand the tendencies of that time period. Nowadays, what, you know, how appropriate for your show Time Signatures. But nowadays with the internet, things are much less regional. But back in the day, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and the 60s, you know, there wasn't the same ability to hear things that were outside of the basic neighborhood area. You know, so you found like regional styles in Mississippi and New Orleans and California and Texas.
Yes, sir.
And people would have their own variety of that particular subset of the style. But nowadays, everything is much more informed, so people can play all those different styles or do that. You know, of course, where you're from has an impact. I'm from Chicago, so when I'm getting down to a blues, I'm getting down in a Chicago sensibility. But then again, sometimes I'll play with things that call upon a more Louisiana vibe or something like that. And Lazy Lester was a house guest at my place many, many times.
Oh,
so,
wow.
You know, I can say that I've gotten some, you know, firsthand training from a true master of the Louisiana swamp blues tradition. So, but anyway, what I'm getting at is that it's fun when you're doing the radio show to be able to point out, okay, here's a set of swamp blues harmonica. Here's a set of Chicago blues. Here's a set of songs featuring Little Walter, which are, of course, as Chicago as it gets.
Oh, yeah.
Here's some great female R&B from the 50s, you know, things like that. So, you know, I break it up into segments like that. I think they're really fun to listen to. I like hearing it that way. It kind of helps me explore one thing then another and gives people a good little tour of the blues when they listen to my radio show. So,
well, I have to tell you, for those that are interested, I think we've whetted the appetites of everybody watching and listening so far. If you want to check out those Lowdown Blues, it's Sunday evenings from 6 to 11 p.m. Mountain Time. Okay. When the time changed from daylight savings into Eastern Standard or vice versa, I never remember which they are. But anyway, when we went through the time change a little over a week ago, I lost an hour because we sprang forward. So what that meant for me is I could no longer listen for 2 hours. I could only listen for one because I have to get up early in the morning. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to start recording this. So I have a digital means of recording those Lowdown Blues. And now I get all 5 hours and I go in and I edit out the little PSAs that you read. And it's just you talking about the music and the music. That's it. And so I end up with like 4 hours and 40 minutes and I love it. One of the other things that you do, I think that's pretty cool, is you always celebrate the birthdays of the musicians. And you play a little, you know, a little bit of a feature on that. How did that get started? Is that just something that you decided to tie in with your themes? Because you seem to have a theme or two every week, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is developed. I used to not really be that concerned about it, or I'd have a thing of where I'd really feature Chicago blues or Texas blues in a particular week. And, you know, as you do it, you just keep thinking of different ways that you want to, you know, spice it up and add some different things and give sure. you an excuse to explore and dig a little bit deeper in your own collection. So, you know, when I'm doing the radio show, I'm both a teacher and a student because I'm learning about what I'm going to play. And
yes,
I'm
sir.
Like, oh, that's really cool. Let me check out some of these other tracks. Cause well, you know, I don't know about you, but we all have our like pet tracks on an album. And then sometimes there's other great tracks on there But, you know, in our rush, we just go and grab that, thinking about the track that we're familiar with. But it's fun to, like, dig a little bit deeper. And sometimes you hear it the first time, it doesn't hit you. The second time, you're like, oh, why? How did I miss that? That's brilliant, you know? So anyway, I still get a thrill after all those years. I listen to this stuff, and it just makes me feel alive when there's some great songs. Plus, I'm always looking for new cool songs to cover in recording sessions. So all of a sudden, like, oh, that'd be a great song for Tia Carroll. That'd be a great song for so-and-so. And then, yeah, it's fun to kind of listen to it with that in mind also, because sometimes there's just these old songs that are just begging to be redone because they're too good to just be held back. They're meant to be covered. So
I was listening to a song on the way home. Ain't Nobody Here But Us Chickens. Yeah. I was playing on BB King's Bluesville on the way home. And I was like, that's a catchy little tune, man. It's something I could hear on Bob's show.
Right. Did you hear the BB King version, or did you hear the,
I think that might've been who, I think it was BB. I don't think it was the original.
The original is by Louis Jordan.
Yes, sir.
And yeah, fun fact, might've been BB. Louis retired in Phoenix, Arizona in the 1950s and had the only two-story house in South Phoenix, he participated in all these wonderful charity events for the community. And he was really the pride of the community. People would go over to his house and feel really connected to him. He was just great that way. And, he eventually passed away, and the house was sold to Louis Farrakhan, who lives there now, which is kind of some interesting Black history. People don't think of Phoenix with its Black history, but there's a bunch of Black history here.
So, yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
So, Bob, I want to step back in time just for a few minutes here so I can get some more stories from you. For those of you that don't know, Bob's originally from Chicago. I'd like you to take us back, if you will, and share what it was like hearing Muddy Waters for that first time when you were just 12 years old.
Oh, well, that was pretty amazing because it was on the radio. FM radio was just kind of coming into its own. There's a rock station that played the song Rolling Stone by Muddy Waters. And it was just Muddy and his electric guitar. And I listened to that and I go, that is the coolest thing. That's exactly the main ingredient of what I like in the pop music that was going on at that time. Because back then there was, you know, the Doors and Jefferson Airplane and Steppenwolf, and a lot of people were adding blues elements into their rock, into their pop music. And I really enjoyed that. But when I heard the root of it all, the Muddy Waters, it was like, oh, there it is. And from that point forward, Muddy was my North Star. So I got on my bicycle, I went over to Paul's Recorded Music in downtown Wilmette, Illinois, and I picked up the record Muddy Waters Sail On, which had the song Rolling Stone on it. So I listened to it, and I was already a fan of harmonica. I just loved it. And I heard that, and there's all these wonderful performances of Muddy Waters with the full band, with Little Walter playing harmonica, and I'm just knocked out. I just couldn't even believe what I was hearing. It was so poetic. It was so perfect. And I felt like I was home. So Muddy was just great. I ended up doing my junior theme in high school on Muddy Waters. And the first time I ever got to see Muddy Waters live was when he played my high school gymnasium my senior year.
No kidding. Did you have anything to do with that show?
No, I just did. Whoever was in charge of the bookings got that show together, and it was just an amazing thing. So little would I know that some of the people in that band would become some of my best friends later in life, and I'd work very closely with them. So, you know, Pine Top Perkins and Bob Margolin especially, you know. So,
yes, sir.
These are some really great people that I got to know by, you know, got to work with Fuzz. I got to work with Luther Guitar Jr. Johnson. I got to work with Willie Big Eyes Smith and produce a record on him. Lots of fun stuff. So, but again, it seems like Muddy Waters opens all doors. And when you talk about Muddy Waters, you're also talking about All the Great Little Walter that was recorded. Muddy always had the harmonica as like one of the main features of each of the songs. His bands were constructed with the harmonica in the hot seat. So, and
right.
after, you know, after Little Walter came James Cotton and George Harmonica Smith and Junior Wells and Big Walter Horton, and then, you know, late in later years, Paul Asher and Sherry Portnoy and Mojo Buford. I mean, all of these harmonica players, every one of them was fantastic, because that was, you know, if you're going to be a Muddy Waters band, and be a harmonica player, you better be able to occupy that seat with some authority. So all those guys did. I mean, it's just it's beautiful. And those songs were defined not only by Muddy's voice and guitar sound and the beat and the great Chicago beat, but by the harmonica that was always set up to carry the song. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, according to what I read, it didn't take you long to dive headlong into the blues, beginning your lifelong love affair with the harmonica and collecting blues albums. Now, Bob, if I were a betting man, I would be willing to bet some money that you still have some, if not all, of your original vinyl albums.
I've got many, yes.
Okay. It doesn't,
okay.
That's not a surprise, man.
Yes, there may be a few I've lost, but, you know, all right, here's a little teaser for you.
Okay. Oh, man. Wow.
Okay, sorry about that.
No, that's great. I love it. I love it.
Okay.
So anyway, do you was Muddy your first blues concert at the high school, or was there another one?
No. I love Muddy, but the first show that I ever saw that was an official blues show was the Sam Lee Blues Revival, which was just great. It had Eddie Taylor on the guitar, Wild Child Butler on harmonica. It had Detroit Jr. on piano, and everybody, it was like a big review. So, and then Johnny Twist and Lucille Spann were also part of the big, you know, parade of different artists that Sam Lee would host up on there. And of course, Sam was a great singer and drummer himself, but it was a fantastic show. And later on, I get to work and be great friends with Sam. So that was very powerful. But I got to see that show. Prior to that show, I did get to see Ike and Tina Turner over at Ravinia Park, which is north of Chicago. And
okay.
I didn't realize it, but that show was very blues heavy. You know, of course, Ike came from the blues and was a crucial part of, you know, the development of blues. He brought Howlin' Wolf and B.B. King to the Bihari Brothers in Modern Records, and played on Elmore James records and all
wow.
sorts of stuff. Little Milton once said to me, if it wasn't for Ike Turner, there'd be no Little Milton. So anyway, seeing Ike and Tina Turner and that unbelievable band, I mean, Tina was a stick of dynamite and the Ikeettes were amazing. But before they even came out, the band did a couple of the hottest instrumentals. And I'm just going, wow, that is something else. That was like the whole Chitlin' Circuit thing. And it was just like a real blues-based, jazzy kind of thing with great horn sections and Ike's guitar. It was fantastic. Then Tina came out, and, I mean, it was one of the most energetic shows ever imaginable. So I saw that one before I saw a proper blues show, because that was, you know, that was a blues-based thing being marketed to pop culture and doing so very successfully. But So, but then I got to see Otis Rush over at Barrett College. I could go to the pizza joint very close by where I was at in Evanston, Illinois, called The Spot. And Blind Jim Brewer used to play there every Tuesday. So
wow.
We'd order some slices and we'd applaud for Blind Jim. And he would just, the more you applauded, the blueser he got. So it was just great. Northwestern University was right around there. We could see Luther Allison.
Okay.
Over there, they had this McGraw Hall, which was pretty amazing because, you know, as somebody who couldn't get in the bars yet, you know, we were able to see a show called The Memphis Blues Caravan, which had Bucca White, Furry Lewis, Sleepy John Estes with Hemi Nixon, Harmonica Frank Floyd, the King Biscuit Boys with Houston Stackhouse and Joe Willie Wilkins. It was just unbelievable, you know, to see that show at such an early age and not even really know that you were seeing some of the most amazing masters of country blues in that show.
Yes, sir.
And it was just great. I remember seeing Bucca White and going, I thought it was the craziest thing because he played his guitar almost as much of as a percussion instrument as he did with as a melody instrument, because he was playing the big national steel guitar, and you know, he was hitting on it and percussive beats and doing all sorts of stuff. And I'm going, it just was something that expanded my viewpoint of what was possible. You know, and of course, all that stuff was just coming from a very, you know, homespun, you know, way. It has its own, you know, rural sophistication, which is kind of an oxymoron, but it was just absolutely gorgeous. It was, you know, so well crafted in a way that took me to a whole other world than the one I was being raised in. So
sure,
it was pretty amazing. And then when you get in the clubs, oh my God. Oh, and let me back up a little bit. So Northwestern University had Mark Gunchen and Best of Blues. I used to stay home on Saturday nights and listen to that program because it was just such a awakening to be able to hear all the different things, to be able to hear Clifton Chenier playing blues on accordion, to be able to hear Sonny Terry for the first time. I remember all those moments of just awakening to the new things in the blues that I was not aware of until I heard them on the radio. So that was great. And then I went off to college in Tulsa, Oklahoma, but was always eager to get back to Chicago for the summers and for the spring break and the Thanksgiving break and the Christmas break. And I would just hit all the blues clubs, because at that point I could get into the blues clubs. And, you know, how cool is it to be able to go see the Bob Reedy Blues Band with special guests Johnny Little John, Eddie Clearwater, and Carrie Bell? Or then the next week and go back there and see Coco Taylor and meet her, and her and her husband inviting us to sit with them on the breaks, you know. And wow. You know, just it was just that kind of thing. And blues and black culture in general was just so accepting to this young student that was all eager-eyed and wanted to learn all he could, and you know, get invited up on the bandstand to sing with the band a little bit. It was just an amazing situation of acceptance and of passing the torch down to the young whippersnapper who was trying to get it done. And you know, apparently I knew just enough where they recognized what I was doing and gave me tips and support and encouragement. And I just was a sponge. I took in everything I could take in. So
speaking of young whippersnappers, if my timeline is correct in my head, you were there when Butterfield, Bloomfield, Musselwhite, Bishop, Siegel, and the others were just beginning to take flight in Chicago, weren't you?
Well, Paul Butterfield really took hold in the 60s. And okay. But Sam Lay was part of that original Paul Butterfield band.
Yes.
But Paul had already left Chicago when I was able to get into the clubs.
Okay.
But I was able to see him once in Chicago. I was overseeing seeing Coco, and Pop's, her husband said, yeah, Paul Butterfield's going to play the whole next set with us. So he just came in and just played harmonica behind Coco Taylor, which was beautiful. And then in 1974, also, I won a radio contest. We used to have those, you know, and they said, all right, you can win a thing to this sound stage. It's a blues tribute show, but you have to know, it's the first person that can call in and give me the actual name for Muddy Waters. Of course, I was already way into Muddy Waters. I called McKinley Morganfield. You win! It's like, yay! So I got That's a couple cool. tickets to the sound stage, and I got to see Muddy with Junior Wells and Willie Dixon and Coco Taylor, and They also had Johnny Winter on that, and Mike Bloomfield and Nick Gravanites. Willie Dixon was there.
Wow.
And all of that was recorded. It's actually on a video. And it's kind of funny because if you listen, the very first song that they actually play is Blow and Blow. And
okay.
It's a Muddy Waters band. And right after Pinetop Perkins' piano solo, they pan right into the crowd. And you can see this hippie kid, which was me, bobbing his head. And somehow for 1 second, they have a close-up of me. And then they pan it out to the crowd. And everybody else had the hippie hair, because that was what you did in 1974. It's
sure.
kind of funny. So, but it's funny to look back on it. So if anybody would ever accuse me of not loving Muddy Waters, I could easily point to that and says, I've been loving Muddy Waters for a long time.
Yeah, no
Take a look
kidding.
At this. So,
Bob, what was your first paying gig as a harmonica player? You remember what you made for it and where it was?
Well, you know, it's funny because in high school, I used to play in a band, and we used to just play parties, you know, and I think we may have made a couple bucks here and there if we went to some faraway place to play, but yeah, you know, it was never really about that. But then when I went to college, I was the only guy in Tulsa that was really playing a Chicago style blues harmonica. So I found myself in big demand over there. I was working quite a bit, doing the classes during the day and the nightclubs at night. I was kind of living a double life. And so I got a lot of work there. In Chicago, when I went back to Chicago, I really felt that I was more of a student, but I was happy to sit in. And that was kind of a way of life in Chicago. So if I went to see Mighty Joe Young, he would call me up. Coco Taylor would usually have me play a couple of numbers with her
Nice.
band. There are various people that were very good. Little Max Simmons invited me up to play. All these people were encouraging. And then at that point, the night that I met Little Max Simmons, in his band that night was Lonnie Brooks. It was pre-Alligator Lonnie Brooks. Lonnie invited me to where he was playing at with his own band. So I went at his encouragement, and he had me play for a whole set. And at that point, Lonnie was kind of like the Chicago Blues jukebox. He had all of the Chicago Blues classics as part of his repertoire. So he'd just do
okay.
a whole bunch of harmonica songs when I was there. And then at the end of the night, he'd thank me for coming down and tell me when the next show is, invite me down again. So I got some really valuable stage time with Lonnie that I'll never forget. That was really, really wonderful. And here's another interesting story that is kind of embarrassing, but in a way it's just how it had to be, you know? So I'd sit in with Coco's band, and then Pop said, you know, we're thinking about adding another piece to the band. Will you come to the rehearsal and we can see how that would sound? And I thought that was really exciting. And but I was going to college at that time, and I was still living under my parents' authority. You know, I would have had to have borrowed the car. So I told them, I asked if I could borrow the car to go to this rehearsal audition. And they said, oh no, oh no, you're going back to college. That's your plan in life. And I knew that they were right, but I'm sure it was painful. It kind of made me feel really embarrassed that I wasn't really in charge of my own life at that time. But it was kind of what needed to happen. I was probably not ready to be on the road in a blues band at that point. I was still pretty mischievous and, you know, young, and I was partying more than we should. But, you know, when we're young, we can get away with that. I would later, at age 24, I quit drinking. And I think that was a good call, because
yes, sir,
I just had a lot more space in my life for music because of that. But, you know, who knows what would have happened if that were the path I would have gone down. And, you know, I really did use my college degree. You know, I run a business in Phoenix and all that. And but the irony of that is that it was kind of like it was an unfinished story. So years later, I just got in my head that I should make the attempt to see if I could record with Coco. And I called Bruce Iglar and asked him if he would allow me to realize my dream. And he I made what I thought was a generous offer, which I think it was. And Bruce brought it to Coco, and Coco agreed. And next thing you know, I'm setting up a recording session with Coco in Chicago.
Wow.
So I got to do that. And it was the full circle, because I was denied the opportunity to play in her band, but I then later got to do this. And it was, you know, Coco was always such a beautiful person. But after we did two great songs, which both have been released, and they're really powerful. But then after that, I got this beautiful letter from Coco thanking me for recording her music. And it was just the most kind and gracious letter that you could ever get. It was just sweet. So,
and I'm
anyway,
betting you still have that letter, don't you?
You know what? It's somewhere, but I have not been able to find it. I've been looking for that. But if you ever saw the stacks of the piles of nostalgia that are lining my house, it would be funny if it weren't that I actually have to live in that house. But anyway, it's beyond being able to organize. And every time I try and organize, I make a bigger mess. So, but it's, I do have it somewhere, I believe, you know?
Okay.
So,
well, Bob, since
go on.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm just rattling stuff off. Pardon me.
No, you're fine.
One of those guys. You get me going, I'll just tell you a million stories. So,
well, that's all right. That's what we're doing here. But
right.
I do want to turn the page, because you've been featured on well more than 100 releases to date. I mean, I'm just guesstimating here. You've appeared on all the big labels, including Viztone, Delmark, Hightone, Blind Pig, Earwig, and Ruff, just to name a few. And your work has been nominated, or you've won several Handy, Grammy, Living Blues, Blues Music Awards, Blues Blast Awards. Are there any of these that stand out particularly as special to you?
Every one of them is special. Every one of them is an honor. By the way, I was a part of two. People sometimes say, well, you're Grammy nominated. But the reality is I co-produced Kim Wilson's Smoke and Joint record, which was live at the Rhythm Room, or most of it was. And then I also played harmonica on one track on one of Pinetop Records records, which was up for a Grammy. Neither of those won, but I was associated with a nominated record, but that doesn't really, technically I'm not a Grammy nominee unless my name was on there, but maybe someday that'll happen, which would be great. But every one of them is important. Every one of them stands for something, you know, just you put your love out there in a release and you give it to the world to embrace, and you hope they love it because you put a lot of love in that, and you hope they feel that love and then they give you love back. And it happens a lot of times. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes I might think I just did something that was so special and it might not gain the kind of attention that maybe you would hope it would, but it's okay because it exists as a work that I'm satisfied with. And that's that right there is the first hurdle. And after that, everything is there. So again, you put out the love, you hope you get the love back. It was very gratifying to win a Living Blues Award for Best Harmonica Player. You know, to win various Blues Blast Awards for different things. I've gotten two BMA awards. There's another radio show called the Blues Lounge Radio, and I've been showered with awards from them. I guess I'm a big hero of that radio show. And it's just nice to have that kind of reinforcement and encouragement. Although, you know, I would still do it if I didn't get that, but it is great reinforcement. It helps the label sell more records.
Sure.
Gives a higher profile to me as an artist, helps me with booking. So it is important, but at the same time, you know, if you're in a category with five other great artists, just to be nominated is amazing. And you think about all the other great artists that aren't even nominated. So,
right.
Yeah, I feel grateful and blessed and humbled by that all the time. And I just, I hope that I'm living up to the promise of what people are offering me as far as celebrating the work that I've done. So that's something I hope I can do. And well, I try every release to make sure it's something that is vetted with all my all of my carefulness and love and the things that you want to put into an album.
And I think that feeds in very well to my next question for you, because one of the hallmarks of your work in Chicago blues music is your steadfast dedication to true blues music. And it's paid great dividends for you. You worked with the likes of Tail Dragger, Big Moose Walker, Willie Buck, just to name a few. I know you've built long-lasting friendships with these musicians through the years. Talk about some of these guys, would you please?
Well, I mean, Willie Buck was the first guy. You know, this goes back to your question, which I never really answered. The first paying gig I had in Chicago in a real deal blues band was when Willie Buck hired me. And okay. I showed up, and I was friends with all the legends in the band already, but I couldn't believe I'm actually on stage working a gig with them. But they had Lewis and Dave Myers, who were both, you know, sidemen in Little Walter's band, part of the legendary Aces band. Odie Payne, who was the drummer for Elmore James and many others. Big Moose Walker, who played with all sorts of people, including Earl Hooker. And Byther Smith, who was a great star in his own right. That was the band that little old me was playing with. And I'm up there next to Lewis on the stage. I go, Lewis, who I was good friends with and who was really a teacher of mine. I said, Lewis, I don't know if I'm supposed to be up here with y'all. He goes, you playing, go on. And, you know, the feeling of that kind of acceptance was great. And then after those gigs with Willie Buck, inevitably, Moose and Lewis and myself, we'd hang out till the sun came up, just telling jokes and partying and just having a good time. It was just so fun, you know. And those two were such a comedy team, and I got to be just in there, just chuckling and laughing at their jokes, and maybe adding a few minor ones. But I just left all the heavy lifting to them. So
yeah.
But it was, you know. How great. And Willie and I still work together. We put out an album in 2025 that's just a really heavy album, very much in the Muddy Waters tradition, with Bob Margolin, who I first saw in my high school gymnasium. So it just seems to be this this kind of connectivity with one thing over the other. First time I met Tail Dragger was a couple days after Howlin' Wolf died at Howlin' Wolf's club. Wolf died on the Saturday. I found out on the Sunday. The next day, I was over at the club, the 1815 club, where I used to go see Howlin' Wolf.
Sure.
And there was Tail Dragger in all his glory. You know, he was crawling on his stomach on the bar, knocking over drinks, and just being perfectly Tail Dragger. I go, I don't know who this guy is, but I like him. And, you know, years later, we'd make records together. We'd travel around the world. You know, he'd call me regularly and I'd call him. You know, if I needed a place to stay in Chicago, he had a guest room at his house. I was always welcome. You know, things like that. It's just a thing where it becomes more than just a professional relationship or even a family, even a friendship. It becomes more like a extended member of your family. Louisiana Red was like that. He came out to Phoenix. He was staying with a woman who kicked him out after a week, told me to come pick him up. I'm like, get in, Red. So next thing you know, my brother and I and my girlfriend adopted him, and he stayed with us, you know, and he was an orphan. He needed a place to stay. But I mean, he was born as an orphan, you know, so he went from orphan home to orphan home. So for me to give him a home for a year was a really powerful thing. And we stayed friends for the rest of his life, you know? And whenever we got together, the connection was so powerful because, you know, we just loved each other, just how it was. We, you know, we were in the trenches together and we looked out for each other. That was good. So there's, you know, now I'm working a lot with Jimmy Primetime Smith, who's a great guitar player. I met him in 1978 when he was playing guitar with Big Walter Horton. He's the son of Johnny May Dunson, and Jimmy Reed was the person that first taught him how to play guitar. His first gig he was still a teenager, was the 1973 Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival.
Oh, man.
And, you know, so, I mean, this is a pretty heavy credentialed guy, and so all of a sudden I've got a little Chicago in Arizona, which is kind of what Arizona has been for me. And I mean, I came to Phoenix and Luzianne Red followed me out there. I recruited Chico Chisholm to come out. He came out in 86 and spent the last 20 years of his life. I met Dave Riley through a guy named Tom Colson over at the King Biscuit Blues Festival. He said, I got some family out there. I said, well, next time you're in town, let me know and let's get you a gig over at the Rhythm Room. So we sat in and then, you know, we played the last 15 years of his performance. He got COVID and got a COVID stroke and he recently died. From like 2005 to 2020, we worked a lot together and made three albums, toured all around the world, Brazil, France, Switzerland, just a lot of, you know, wonderful experiences with that guy. And yeah, he was a rowdy country boy, you know, times he had me pulling out my hair, but you know, we were like brothers, you know. I go, Dave, I hate that I love you. He goes, he called me a choice of name that started with an A. And that's how that went. You know, we were like quarreling brothers the whole time, but we always had each other's back. So that was just kind of the rowdiness of our friendship. So, but anyway, these are some of the many people that were really close. You know, Henry Gray, I met him, brought him into town. I ended up bringing him to town every year, once or twice. And then we played all around the world together. And in the end, he lived till 95 and he was performing till 94. In 92, wow. He had a lung collapse. He wasn't able to fly out anymore, but we'd still do shows together in driving distance. I'd fly into Baton Rouge, rent a car and drive him to, you know, the festivals like the Crescent City Blues and Barbecue Festival or the Baton Rouge Blues Festival. And, you know, at the very end of his life, I flew out to visit him on his 95th birthday. He was pretty much bedstricken at that time. He had lost so much weight. It was kind of hard to see him that way. But we got our last time, and the nurse got him up out of bed and put him in the piano, and we got to play one last time. And
nice.
We didn't even want to let go when we had to shake hands goodbye. So I'm going to stop there before I.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm going to hopscotch around a little bit here because you ended up moving out to Phoenix in 1981.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, you were joined by Luzianne Red. You guys gave Phoenix a real taste of the Chicago blues out there, which is kind of cool. And then as we spoke earlier, you took on the radio show at KJZZ, those Lowdown Blues. But in 1991, you opened what now has become the premier blues and roots concert club, the Rhythm Room. What motivated you to make that move at that particular time, Bob?
Well, that was the first club I ever booked at. And I booked Luzianne Red there in the early 80s. It was then called the Purple Turtle, but it was a kind of good space. And I went in and playing there and Tommy Duke's band and Big Pete Pearson's band, a bunch of different bands. And it was just a good room. So I'm sitting there wondering how I was going to do all this. I was 35 years old and I hadn't really made a mark for myself the way I wanted to, and I'm sitting there trying to reevaluate. And whatever that does, I just say a prayer to God and I just ask for direction. And sure enough, it always seems to come. And so I get a phone call from the guy that was a property owner of that particular thing, that venue. It had been closed for a while, and he wanted to restart up as a blues bar, and he wanted me to develop a business. I go, this is a prime opportunity. And he seemed serious, and he certainly was. So we met, and next thing you know, I was involved in the club business. I had done a little bit of work booking at some clubs. There's a concert place called Chewy's, and also I brought some shows into the Mason Jar. Before that, I brought Otis Rush and Rockin' Doopsie and Anson Funderburg and the Rockets with Sam Myers and Little Charlie and the Nightcats were some of the acts that I would bring in. brought in Clarence Edwards and Jimmy Dotson. So some lesser known, some bigger names, but I, you know, I was bringing in some stuff. So I knew my way around booking things. And I brought Robert Lockwood in, into town, who I knew from both Tulsa and from Chicago. So anyway, I thought, well, I'd probably be pretty good at this. So I'm like, okay. So next thing you know, I'm hired to develop a business on this guy's property. And it was the Rhythm Room, opened on September 18th, 1991.
Wow.
And it immediately kind of filled a gap that was needed in Phoenix at that time. And it just kind of upped the game for the blues. And there were a lot of different people who were coming by. Now, I knew that I was going to be able to really provide a great service to the community. And I also knew that I was going to be in the path of all these great blues artists I was going to book. And that when they came through town, I might, just maybe, be able to entice them to go into the recording studio too. So at that point, and I had already produced some records. I was no stranger in the studio. I'm like, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. So I immediately latched onto that opportunity and just saw it for what it was, a way to just, you know, record history while guys were still out there. And, you know, these guys at that point in time, people were riding around in their vans. Gas was cheap and, you know, there were places to play and, you know, the road to where you were going was dotted with different places you could stop and get weekday gigs, you know. So here we were, and everybody who needed to get to or from Los Angeles was going to need to stop by my club. And, you know, I did my best to record as much of it as I could. And that, from there came the Vault series, which, you know, is has been, you know, a wonderful little force of just being able to show people some of the stuff that I've recorded over the years that had been stockpiled because I was recording it way more than I could ever release. You know, I didn't have the release mechanism that I do now. But I was just recording it and putting the masters in a closet and just letting it grow. And then, eventually I put out the first record in 1999. And it was a year after my mom died and my dad had died 4 years before that, and I knew I had some good stuff, but I didn't want to start on that road before I felt that my job was done looking out for my parents. So
sure,
I waited until then. I go, okay, well, I guess my life is my own now. It's time to release some of the highlights of that. So I put out my first record, and what's interesting is my Chicago friends from labels, they knew me as the student, the harmonica geek. They really couldn't see me as an artist that they would invest in. They didn't really know me in that way. And so they were like, well, this is a good record, but no, we can't use it. It took High Tone Records, which is actually a huge record label, had Robert Cray. They fell in love with the record, and they were the first record label that took me on, and happily so. And I had a great relationship with them and really love them, stuck with them until they've retired the label. So, but it was kind of interesting just that the people that knew me so well, they didn't really see me in that role. They really liked the record, they say, but yeah, I can't use it.
Wow.
I wasn't a marketable enough deal, I guess. So it wasn't until some years later that I realized the impact that I had. In 2005, I went to Europe for the first time and played a festival in Italy that was booked by a couple French promoters. And they immediately got in my corner. And next thing you know, I mean, I was like big news in Europe, you know, because I was putting together these great bands with like real deal blues singers that were out there and crackerjack bands that were able to go and knock out some cool blues and shuffles, you know. So all of a sudden I had a big run in Europe, and very gratifying. And that prompted me, of course, to have more confidence in my recordings, understand that I was actually an entity that had value, you know.
Oh,
And
yeah.
they looked at me in the whole regard. A lot of people in the United States were like, well, you can't be a club owner and a DJ and a musician, so pick one and leave the rest, dude, you know. But in France, they're like, they just loved that I was, you know, doing the whole thing. They called me a blues renaissance man. As a matter of fact, there's a something called Collective Des Radios Blues. It's a group of French speaking DJs around Europe, and I played the Cognac Blues Festival. I think it was 2008, and right before our performance at a beautiful old castle there, they presented me with a beautiful trophy and declared me the godfather of Collective Des Radios Blues. And and I'm like, okay. And to this day, you know, I go to France and some people say godfather. So, well, of course, I have this Sicilian heritage. So what can you say? So,
well, yeah. I want to go back for just a minute to talk about these recording sessions. Now, did you have a studio that you work with out there in Phoenix? Is that where you go to do these sessions?
Well, in Tempe, Arizona, and I live in Scottsdale, and we're all tucked into Phoenix as part of the Phoenix metro area.
Sure.
But there's a guy named Clark Rigsby, and Clark, you know, always had his eye on being, you know, having a recording studio. And so he and my brother went out to Phoenix first. You know, my brother was pretty influential because he gave me my first harmonica, but he also went out to Arizona. And I was at a point, I was wondering where my life was going. And he said, why don't you come out here and stay with me for a little while? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I need to catch up with my brother, see what he's doing. Because we were living different places. We had kind of grown, but in separate areas. We're so close. But, you know, so I went out there to stay with him, thinking I was just going to stay in Arizona for a year. So I didn't know that I would end up, you know, putting down roots here and staying. So anyway, the question you asked me, I think, was about recording sessions, right? So I need to get back. I need to cross the bridge to get over there. So, but I had already recorded a couple albums, and then while Louisiana Red was staying, I had recorded an album of solo Red, the same stuff he'd play around my house. And I had to get, but it was so raw and so real that most people rejected it. You know, it wasn't until like 15 years later that Earwig Records would accept that, right? They wanted that record, and so they put it out, and it created this whole other USA, this whole other USA interest in Red, who had been living in Germany. When he went off on a tour after Arizona, met his wife in Germany, and stayed over there. So we had kept in touch by letters. Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
So, but then all of a sudden he was coming to the United States for a month each year during the summer. And Michael Frank, who I sold to, was also part of the tours. And we were able to make it. Red just insisted that we spend the last week of every tour in Arizona. And so we have one night for dinner, another day in the recording studio, a Friday and Saturday over at the Rhythm Room.
Wow.
And then he'd co-host my radio show with me. And, you know, I mean, he was responsible for me first getting into the Rhythm Room, because that's where I booked him. And he's responsible for me to first get into the radio show. So here he comes. He's a proud big brother that all of a sudden I own the joint that we used to play in, and that I'm now have my own radio show. So it was, you know, it was a Bob coming of age thing for Red. It was him just so happy and proud for me, you know.
You know, so, looking at these recording sessions, I mean, talk about a who's who.
I haven't even gotten to that point yet. I haven't
Oh,
crossed
go
the
ahead.
bridge yet.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, it was amazing because it's like, okay, let's see if, Jimmy Rogers was like first on my list. And that happened. I got Luther
Man.
Tucker, John Brim, Henry Gray, Arl Burnside, all these. And then, a lot of the local guys too we have some heavy blues players. So I was able to get Big Pete Pearson, a guy from Africa called Chief Shabute Giliame, just different people I got to record with from Phoenix, Dr. Fish, Chico Chisholm, of course. There were some heavy local guys there. And so I did my best to try and get them in the studio and make sure that that history is recorded.
Yeah,
so
man.
It's just kind of good stuff, and now we got Jimmy Primetime Smith and we got Carla Denise, who's featured on the new album, The Ernestine Blues, on three numbers. What a great vocalist she is. I met her in Lucerne when she was singing for Mississippi Heat. And at that point, I complimented her on singing. I said, I hope we get to work together someday. And just like a couple of years ago, I got a phone call. Hey, Bob, I'm going to be moving to Phoenix. I go,
wow.
Is this Carla who I met in Lucerne? Yep. So now we're like working regularly together. So
that's cool.
It is cool, and like I say, there's all these, things that happen years, and then they're like ideas or thoughts that just hatch, and all of a sudden they become reality. It's a pretty cool thing. So
yeah, no kidding.
But there's so many people. I've got to record Nappy Brown. I got to record Bo Diddley and
Honey Boy Edwards.
Honey Boy Edwards. Smokey Wilson. Just a lot of really cool things. So when people were coming to town, I invite people to have a gig and then offer them a second gig, and everybody walk away with some money. And I ended up with some historical masters by some artists. And I had Chico Chisholm as part of my studio band. And Chico was Howlin' Wolf's last drummer. I mean, he had the thing. So I had a great great band. A guy named Johnny Rapp was my go-to guy, and a guy named Paul Thomas on the bass. So these were the early guys. It would develop later, most of those guys were not really ready to tour. And so I ended up, moving on to some people that were more tour ready, which it's a whole other animal. The people who are in town and just play locally are wonderful and great. But I much prefer to work with people that are able and willing to go out on the road when it happens, because that's a whole other type of person.
Sure.
And not everybody's cut out for that. Some people just can't handle being away from home.
Right.
So, or they might like the idea of it, but when it comes down to the actuality of that, missing their loved ones for a week, things like that, or 2 weeks or a month, that's not something most people do well with. So,
well, Bob, I have to give a hats off to you, man, because you have single-handedly built one of the most incredible archives of some of the biggest names in the blues, and it's one hell of a legacy. I've got to believe, despite all of the Vault Series albums that you've released, there's got to be more lurking in that sacred safe of yours, is there not?
There's so much, but it takes time, it takes money.
Right.
It takes presence of mind to be able to do all that. Sadly, the pandemic really helped me get a foothold on that, because I couldn't really record new stuff. And so I was able to go into the vault and really, really set up the stage for the series. And there's more that I want to do. But I'm working on, the new releases are kind of important because they're current and they have, I think, a little more value overall in the market. But the historical ones, we just released that early blues sessions, and it's blowing people's minds, because they just, you can't get blues like that anymore. Those types
can't.
Of people, the connection to the architects is no longer there. And the next generations or two, and I'm part of the next generations or two, we don't have the same frame of reference that can so beautifully take you there. But at the same time, at this point, we're about the closest you can get, because we were taught by the masters.
Yeah. Before we leave the subject of your albums, Bob, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, okay? We're not going to talk about it yet, but anybody who's purchased one of your albums have seen the incredible artwork that accompanies these on the covers. Who does this work for you? Because they really seem like they've done a bit of branding magic for you, haven't they?
Well, I was a fan of Vince Ray's work when I used to see posters for Viva Las Vegas up in record stores, you know, and I was like,
okay,
oh man, this guy's great. And I just got the idea that I wanted him to do one of my album covers. And I contacted him. At first, I was using the wrong email, but a friend of mine that knew him, she contacted him and says, hey, Bob Corto's trying to get a hold of you. And so he did the first album cover, which was Don't Let the Devil Ride. And that was a really cool album cover. But now he's on number, let's see, we've got eight, and a ninth one's already been designed for the 2027 release.
Oh,
which
wow.
Will be Voodoo Voodoo. And you can imagine a Vince Ray cover about voodoo. it's pretty cool. So,
you know, one of these times I'm going to have you get one of them autographed by him. I think that would really be cool.
Yeah. I've only met him in person once when I played, because he lives around London. So when I played London, he came out to the show, and we had already known each other through, you know, numerous emails and working on projects together. But it was the first time that we got to meet in person. You know, we got along like, you know, two friends forever, you know. So he laughed at all my bad jokes, and, you know, we got along just fine. So, yeah. No, but he's cool. He's a cool guy. And he loves blues and he loves roots music. So, and I love his art. And, you know, I mean, he's got a real thing. And it kind of paints the picture of what the album is going to sound like, I think.
Yes, it does.
It's got a real vintage sense of tradition. At the same time, it's living in the now, and it's just cool art. So
it is. It really is, Bob. But I would be remiss if I didn't talk to you about your longstanding relationship with yet another Chicago blues legend, and that would be Mr. John Primer. How did the two of you begin working together, and talk about the development of this incredible bond that you two seem to have, musically speaking?
Well, okay. I first became aware of John Primer when I saw him in the 70s. He was just getting started with being the house band at Teresa's. So I go to Teresa's, and Junior Wells was oftentimes there when he was in town. James Cotton, you could hear all sorts of stuff, but the house band itself, with Sammy Lawhorn and all the guys, that was a powerful thing. So, and Mary Lane and Muddy Waters Jr. was always, and he actually had no relationship to Muddy, but he went by the name Muddy Waters Jr. But you know, Junior Wells was, you know, almost all the time playing there when he was in town. And, you know, that was something to behold. But here's John Primer getting his start, and he was kind of the protege of Sammy Lawhorn, who was an older guy who had played in Muddy Waters' band for a long, long time. But he was out there playing every night, doing what he needed to do, and it was just growing and growing. And later on, he would join Muddy Waters' band. I'm so sorry. Somebody tried to call me.
You're fine. Go ahead.
So after that, John Primer joined Muddy Waters Band. He would then be in Magic Slim and the Teardrops. So I was seeing him play with Muddy. I was seeing he played my club with Magic Slim a number of times. And then I became really aware of what a great singer he was when I heard a Muddy Waters tribute. And he was the main singer, and he was killing it. And I go, man, this guy can sing these Muddy Waters songs. Unbelievable. And but for some reason, even though we play some of the same festivals and whatnot, we always say hi to each other, I never work with him. And I was in in Brazil one time, and the promoters like, why you no play with John Primer? John Primer always used harmonica. And I go, you know, I don't have a good answer for that. I don't know why we don't play. Ironically, a month later, his manager calls me up and says, John would like to come out to Phoenix and have your band support him and do a show. And I said, well, it's ironic that you said that because somebody just asked why we hadn't played together yet. And I said, I'd like to do that. And I'd also like to arrange a recording session. So we did a gig. It went great. We did a recording session. From the first note we hit in the recording session, it was fire. And we knew we had something there. I'm like, John, if you want to keep going, we can probably have a good start on a record here. And so we just kept recording that. We did two more recording sessions, put out our first record together. It was number one on the Living Blues charts. We're over at the Blues Music Awards, kind of glowing in the fact that, and I said, I've never been number one on the Living Blues radio charts before. Have you? And he said, no. Do you want to do another record? I said, really? Okay, let's do. So next thing you know, it was that kind of thing. We just enjoyed recording together. And John, you know, and myself both have these, you know, we're both Chicago, you know, I mean, have that Chicago sound. John is definitive of that Chicago sound. I mean, here's a guy raised in Mississippi, came to Chicago, played, you know, and with all the checklist bands, Willie Dixon, James Cotton, Junior Wells, Magic Slim, Muddy Waters, unbelievable. So anyway, we got so much common ground. It's a beautiful thing. And so when we play together, it's this natural thing that happens. This natural, you know, traditional voicing that we put on everything. We speak the same language and we have a pretty damn good conversation with it. So, yes, you know, we did some stuff. And the last record that we made was Crawling Kingsnake, and that just won a Blues Music Award. And I was just talking with Lisa, his wife, and I are working on a West Coast tour right now. And so we're talking about, you know, when that, you know, when the name was called and they said that, and John's like, Bob, let's go up there. And so they're playing the title track and it just was like a dream sequence. I go, is this really happening? Okay. So I'm up there and John says, you first, because John will bring it to the Mississippi and I'll bring it to the, you know, to the DJ voice kind of thing. He always says, you're the DJ, you know, you do this. So, but anyway, so I don't even know what I said. I think it sounded halfway reasonably sensible, but I don't even know because I was just, my head was pumped with adrenaline. Yeah, we had everybody but one of the people who played in the band there. So we got everybody on the stage to join in on the limelight with that. And then John, of course, took it home and did the finale of what I had set it up. You know, I said the thank yous and the more technical parts and mentioned how when we were in the studio, we realized that we were on something really big because I'd gotten like the best possible band for that. You know, just like all aces. And Bob Strozier on the bass right there was...
Oh, man.
You know, that was the secret weapon of that album. It just, it put it exactly where it was supposed to go.
Yes, sir.
Anyway, but no, John and I have had a lot of successes and a lot of fun. And he's a good man. And, you know, I really appreciate his energy towards getting it across. He still has dreams and aspirations. And he treats every performance like it's just a do or die special event. And so when we're on tour, I was like, okay, I better get up to snuff here because there's no slouching with John Primer around. So not that I would slouch anyway, but he just brings it out. He's pure energy.
Yes, sir.
He's amazing.
And how cool is it, Bob, that we just heard within the last couple of weeks that the money has been raised now. There's going to be a historical marker placed in his hometown. How cool is that?
That's very cool. Although, you know, it's kind of sad about it, is that the government funding to make that happen should have just been handled by the government. But now, because all these programs have been cut, they had to do the fundraising on their own. And this is kind of sad that that has to be the case, because John shouldn't have to go fighting for his own recognition. But in a way, I guess we all have to do that in today's world, because it's a noisy world.
I think it's a little sweeter, isn't it, though, to know that his fans have backed him and helped get it there?
Yes, and that's a great way of looking at it. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. It is. It is. So I'm happy for that. But I think that, you know, as musicians, we prefer to give than to take, you know.
Yes.
We, of course, love when people want to buy our albums and our T-shirts and things like that, because then they get to bring a little bit of us home. And that right there is a huge compliment. But overall, we'd rather give than receive, I think.
Yes, sir. Yes,
so that, that's
speaking
just...
and speaking of giving, I'm going to jump off here real quick. In addition to everything else that you're doing, the radio show, the Rhythm Room, the recordings, the festivals, if I'm not mistaken, you're also a longtime mentor with the Pine Top Perkins program each year, aren't you?
Well, I've always been supportive of that. And
sure.
It's really an amazing thing. And I always knew that it was amazing. But I was more involved in like helping with the fundraisers. And so I always did that. And I just took it as my personal responsibility to do that. But I was asked this year, last year, to be an instructor. And so I gladly did that. It was a lot of fun. It was overwhelming to a point that I had given lessons and seminars before, but to be in a class with five dedicated students and young Harold Davenport was the intern. So he was helping me by both providing a guitar accompaniment and then explaining some things in a different way than I would explain it, helping to get some of the points across that some of the students might not have been getting if it were just me. So it was really pretty cool to have him there in that role, because I'm sure eventually he'll be one of the teachers in there also. But but the camaraderie that our class had, and all week we like worked to gain advancement in everybody's skill set. But we also work at trying to get, we all have a show at Ground Zero where we need to have the harmonica class show what we do, you know, in a song presentation. So we had a really fun little boogie woogie and start out with just a couple harmonicas, added the guitar and the drums. And then everybody got a round or two in it. And then the drums kept going, but we all started walking around the audience playing this to various tables. We walked out the door, went around the building, came back in the back door, got back on the stage to finish the song. Anyway, people went nuts.
Wow. That's cool. And while we're talking about young Rel, let's mention a couple of others that are coming up. We got John Tavius Willis.
Yes.
We've got a young man by the name of Sean Mac McDonald. Of course, you got Kingfish out there already.
Yeah.
How do you feel looking at these guys that are coming up in the ranks right now? How do you feel about the future of the blues?
Obviously, there's going to be people to carry it on because these guys are brilliant. And then also, if you're at the Pine Top Perkins thing, or if you go to the IBCs each year, you know, there's all sorts of young aspiring people that want to play the music. The thing that I'm not seeing that I hope is the next thing that's going to come around, and I'm seeing a few younger people in the audiences, but overall, the audiences are of a particular age, and every year, of course, that age gets 1 year older. So I don't see a wave of like, you know, college age people coming, because when I was college age, the North Side bars in Chicago were filled with a whole bunch of eager people wanting to party to the blues. So
right,
it is a different world than it was back then. So
indeed,
if it does come back around, it'll be different, you know. People don't drink like they used to, and laws are different. You know, back then you'd have a drink in one hand and a cigarette in the other, and that's how most people had their lifestyle, you know. So it's just not that way now. So
no, it isn't. It's changed quite a bit.
So well, the delivery system may change a little bit for blues, but it'll always exist.
Bob, your current album, which is about to be released in just 3 days from now on April 10th. For people that wonder if I'm a Bob Courtois fan, you could say that. That is a list of, well, that's just the first page. But that is the list of all 42. This is the 42nd album that I have added from Bob's catalog to my collection. It is called Ernestine Blues, and it's going to be released in 3 days. This is another one of those Bob Courtois and Friends collaborative works that I've come to know and love. Bob, I'd love for you to talk about this for just a minute. Talk about the album that you've put together here, would you please?
Well, you know, as we keep going on with new releases, now the vaults are a separate thing, but the new releases, you always try and move forward in some way, try and capture a particular type of magic that happens in the studio. And sometimes I record an album like that album I recorded, I go, man, there's so much magic on there. Will I be able to bring the next chapter of magic? And lo and behold, I'm now working on the 2026 album, and it's got a whole bunch of magic going on. And so, you know, but each one takes it a little different further, a little step further. And I think I've grown as a producer quite a bit over all these years. And so,
yes, sir.
I'm taking on some things that are a little bit more challenging to do that, you know, like the song, the title track, Ernestine. That was a 1960s single that came out on Sam Cooke's record label. He actually wrote that for somebody named Patience Valentine, a female singer. So we re-recorded that. And where there was sax, my harmonica exists. But, you know, it's got the female backing chorus, you know, singing along. And it's got a great horn section. And it sounds like it could have been recorded in 1960. You know, it's just got that vibe. And so I've learned how to make records like that. They're a little bit more involved. There's also, you know, some great soul blues, Johnny Rawls. And I love the South. What a sweet little celebration of Southern living that is. And then you got Heavy Blues by Willie Buck. I was able to capture the last recording session of Son Thomas. Little did I know, because he was about my age. But when I recorded him, 4 months later, he would pass away unexpectedly.
Yeah.
So we are representing him with a beautiful song on that record. And that's some really heavy country blues. It goes all the way back to the Tommy Johnson style of singing with this beautiful falsetto. It's just something you don't hear anymore. So you know, I try and capture an interesting program that fits well. And to me, that album feels like a collection of short stories all put into a book, because each one of those songs, it takes you to a whole new place and then starts over again with a whole new story in the next song. There's some gorgeous vocals, some really well thought out songs, things with messages, things with metaphors, things with tradition. So I'm really proud of the new one. I think it takes it a few steps further. So, but again, if you listen to any of those records, they all take you on a journey, and they all represent a moment in time. And moving forward, there's things that you just can't get back from the past also. So, yeah. You know, the same year I put out that early blues sessions, and it's an interesting comparison, you know, that from the early blues sessions to this upcoming release, here you have like this real heavy ensemble, but countrified thing from the guys that were right there in the 50s making it to a slightly different generation coming up. You know, there's some some old, I mean, Bob Strozier's in there, 95 years old. Willie Buck has a couple numbers, 88 years old. And then there's some people that are a little bit younger than me, but are still of a mature age, really just pouring it out.
And you've got Ben Levin in there, who is what, 20, was he 23, 24, or maybe not even that old?
He's around that age.
He's just a young guy. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I met him when he was still a teenager, you know, so
what a great
I love
kid,
Ben, and I've been, you know, at one point he allowed me to mentor him as far as just like kind of life philosophies. So I tried to be as responsible as I could. But one of the things I said, man, you really got to up your game, man. You got to, like, you know, wear some stage clothes. If you're going to occupy that space, you just can't look like a normal Midwestern civilian, you know? And so now he's outdressing me, and he's got, you know, he's got his hair pompadoured, you know. I go, all right.
Oh, yeah.
Ben. Yeah. I go, just be careful now. You got to use your superpowers for good and not for evil. So he takes heed, but he's got a wonderful family that loves him very much and provides him with
a great family, top to bottom, man.
Yeah.
Bob, have you got any dreams or visions of slowing down in any way, or are you just going to keep cranking along with those lowdown blues and everything else?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, at some point, this year, the Rhythm Room will turn 35 years old.
Yeah.
And I'm going to turn 70 years old. That's both happening in September of this year. So I don't know. I mean, at some point, I'd like to maybe not be quite so active in the club business. I just see it as harder and harder every year. You know, just more and more obstacles seem to come in the way of running a nightclub. And when I opened it, there was the kind of crowd that would come out, you know, any night of the week. So I had 7 days of things happen. Now people are mainly going for the weekends. And so I'll do, like, sometimes two shows on a Saturday and two shows. I'll do an afternoon and a nighttime show on a Saturday and an afternoon and nighttime show on a Sunday.
Okay.
But you know, it's harder and harder to fill up the weekdays with things. And I don't know. I don't know if I really want to get hip to a lot of the new music to fill my head with all the new stuff that's coming out, though I think a lot of it's really good, to be able to keep up with what I think is needed if you're going to be an active booking person. So eventually I do plan on retiring that aspect, but it would be done so that I would have more time for other things in music.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So it's a different deal. And I'm sure I would still book shows. I don't know exactly how, but I'm not going to stop booking shows. But I just don't know if having a 7 day a week nightclub makes the same kind of sense as it did in 1991 when we opened up. And we've been through September 11th, the 2008 financial crash, and COVID. And every time that you go through something like that, the world changes and never quite comes back the same. So, I don't want to sound like a bummer, but, you know, at some point I hope to slow down that aspect so I can focus on some other things.
Well, I mean, for crying out loud, you deserve it, man. You know, you worked your tail off for all these years. I mean, you know, something's got to give. But the good news is you're not closing down tomorrow or anything like that. As a matter of fact, rumor has it, I think you've got something planned for the 35th and your birthday, which is an annual thing.
That's going to be an amazing thing. Now, we got a bunch of good shows coming up.
Yeah.
And the idea of that is maybe easier than the actuality of it because, you know, I mean, I go to my club. I get to play on my stage where I know the sound perfectly. I've got my amp all ready to go right there. I know exactly what spot to put it in and how to set it. You know, I got my band that I just love, you know. And we go and we rock the house and we've got my friends that come in and love me and my band. And we just go and do that. That'd be a hard thing to say goodbye to. So it's just, but at the same time, it's going to be a bigger and bigger. I mean, everything has gotten so much higher. Insurance costs, you know, all the different people wanting more and more money, and it's not like we're making more money to keep up with that. So that's kind of the trajectory I'm seeing. It's just eventually it's going to be harder and harder. And, you know, I can't imagine, you know, crowding 80 and keeping up the lifestyle I have right now. So
sure. That makes sense.
I do pretty good with, but I still, you know, I have to be realistic, you know? So
yeah.
How many more of these do we have? I think I've got a good, you know, 10 or 15 years, I hope. So
there you go.
But
and I
want to
get out there. I really want to be out there for the 35th. That's my goal for this year, is to make it out there, because I would love, I, you know, I'm a professional photographer. I would love to come out and shoot your show for you and help you document it. And
that'd be great. Please do.
It'd be a lot of fun. All right,
well,
my
you know,
friend.
You're invited.
And I actually have a copy of the poster already.
Yeah. And it's truly a milestone, you know, it really
is.
And we got Bob Strozier coming there, 95 years old. Man. Willie Buck, 88 years old. You know, Oscar Wilson's going to be there. We've got Tia Carroll coming in. We've got Wes Starr, Anthony Girasi. And then, of course, Jimmy Primetime Smith and Carla Denise and myself, us Phoenicians. So those are always a good time. They're very special. Yeah. You can't get anything like that. Nobody else would ever go through that kind of trouble to make something like that happen. So,
and this is a great point for us to talk about this. So I would like you to answer the most important question of our chat today. Where can we send people to learn more about you, the Rhythm Room, those Lowdown Blues, maybe to buy some CDs or merch, I mean, T-shirts, you name it, or to book you for a gig?
Well, you can contact me. I have a Facebook page that I'm very active on. The friend requests one, I'm not that active on, but the musician one I'm very active on. So you don't even need to put in a friend request for that. You just follow the page. And, you know, I do multiple postings every day, and you can get a lot of good information and news and, you know, sometimes historical posts, sometimes humorous posts, but sometimes just good plugs of some places I'm going to be playing at. But that's a great place. Also, I've got a website called bobcorritore.com, bobcorritore.com. And that will give you a whole bunch of history and some of the recent activities. You can sign up for a newsletter on that page. My photo selection on there, there's literally hundreds of photo sections in the photo pages, and literally thousands and thousands of amazing photos in there, many of them very historic. So just, yes, you could spend a few hours in there easily and not even get through everything. But that right there is a huge educational tool. You can listen to the radio show live, real time, 6 to 11, at kjzz.org. You can also find out about the Rhythm Room and the shows that we book. Some are blues, some are not blues, at rhythmroom.com, rhythmroom.com. So those are ways that you can get a hold of me. There's contact information at bobcorritore.com if you're interested in booking. I also give harmonica lessons. So I've got a couple students in Europe, and I do a FaceTime lesson with them. And that's been something I've been enjoying growing into. And it's just great to see the growth of people, and they're getting the shortcuts, the things that it took me years to learn. I'm like, this is how you do that. And they go, oh, okay. I never thought of doing it that way. It's like, oh, okay. You just watch people grow right in front of your eyes. It's fantastic. So,
well, Uncle Bob, it has always been an honor and a pleasure to speak with you, always. I want to thank you, first and foremost, because honestly, you have helped my journey in the blues expand in ways I never thought possible. There's only a handful of people who have done that. You're one of them. I mean, the whole reason, You know, you've made comments before that you're surprised that I'm such a fan of your music. It's real. It's good stuff. It's Chicago blues. I mean, that's why I enjoy it. I don't just buy it to support, you know, the guy selling it. There's stuff in here that I truly enjoy. And I want to thank you for that, because it is, honestly, it's helped me grow as a fan of the music.
Well, thank you. That's the most important thing, because, as you know, my recordings are, they do showcase my harmonica, but that's not the full point of it. My recordings are platforms to present all these great artists. And
yes,
as a harmonica player, I just look at my role as to serve the song, and especially the singer. So I just wrap around my touch to what the others are doing, and I try and make them sound as good as possible. And that's why I have these loyal people that want to come back and keep doing the sessions. I love that. So, and
indeed,
it's exciting when you get to share a beautiful piece of music with somebody, the creation of that, and have the trust that you're going to do a good job in getting that out there, and you can become the delivery system for something that somebody has communicated. When you share that moment with somebody, that's a connection you'll have with them for the rest of your lives. So it's a powerful thing. So
yes, it is.
I'm glad that you like that. That's the whole point, is that let's create some music that's memorable, that's going to last longer than we will. And so that's my mission statement when I make those records.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you once again for joining us today on Time Signatures. I appreciate your time today. And man, you've been very patient with me. You've answered every question I've had, and I couldn't thank you enough.
Jay Irvin, thank you. You're the man. Thank you. And thanks for wearing the Rhythm Room shirt. Appreciate you.
And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Bob Corritore, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time is my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.